Welcome to World of DAS, a show for data enthusiasts. I'm your host, Warren Hoffman, CEO of Safegraph and GP of Flex Capital. For more conversations, videos, and transcripts, visit safegraph.com/podcasts. Hello, fellow data nerds. My guest today is Sam Lessen. Sam is a GP at Slow Ventures and a former Facebook product manager and founder of Finn. He's also a co-host of an excellent podcast that I love called More or Less. Sam, welcome to World of DAS.
Thanks for having me on the World of DAS. Excited to be here.
Amazing. We've been friends for a long time, so I'm really excited to dive in. Now, you wrote this report, this slides presentation that I thought was amazing on venture capital. And it had a lot of hot takes. It was somewhat controversial. So I thought we'd jump into it. The first concept from that report that I really want to dive into is this idea of factory farm unicorns. What is a factory farm unicorn? And why are we not going to see these anymore going forward?
Look, I think there's a bunch of dynamics behind this. But the basic idea of a factory farm unicorn was that in the last bunch of years, you had this weird situation come together where one, the public market, let's work backwards from the end of the factory line. So the public market was really looking for tech growth stories that looked a certain way. And there was kind of this understanding that if you deliver these types of metrics in a SaaS company doing X, Y, and Z, you were worth a few billion dollars and it was a good story. People wanted to buy the IPO. So that's like the end of the factory line. The question is, well, how do you produce these things? Because there was that demand for those, especially when we talk about the zero interest rate environment and why that caused that demand, you ended up kind of with this system that didn't used to exist in venture capital, but it really came together where there's this round-based system starting from seed to A to B to C to D, where everyone kind of understood what the metrics were you were supposed to hit. And you kind of just hit the metrics, and then someone else would price your startup pretty efficiently, do the next amount of work, put the next amount of capital on, and move it down the factory line until you got a public company out the end, which is sold to the public market. Now, the problem was they were pretty factory farm because instead, if you think about like a free range startup, would be the way it used to be, which is you have some crazy idea for some founder. You get some seed capital, you get it going, you hit some milestones, you start to get more confidence, some investors get attracted to it, maybe get a Series A done. Each round of capital is a little bit bespoke. It's not really a market the way it ended up being in the last decade. It was kind of more like there are investors, different people have different theses about what things are worth, pretty opaque. But we ended up in the last decade with this like very cookie cutter system. So you could end up doing just your slice of the pie, your stage of production, and pass it on to the factory until you got a public company. It's all falling apart. That doesn't mean there's no such thing as a startup anymore. It doesn't mean anything's dead. There's a lot of amazing companies to build. You've built a great one. There's a lot of cool stuff going on. But it does mean that this kind of factory farm system, where maybe you start with YC and you go to your seed investors, you go from seed to A once you have $1 million in ARR and it's super efficiently priced because everyone knows what the metrics are they're looking for, to the B, to the C, all the way to public company, that game is over. And then unfortunately, there's going to be a lot, to use the factory farm analogy, there's a lot of product, which is startups in this case, that kind of were somewhere around the CD range that are going to get kind of hung out to dry on the line. It's like expiring inventory of startups, which I think is a big challenge for the industry.
It seemed like to me in this 2018 to 2021 timeframe that you're really kind of diving into, it seemed like most of the VC bets to me seem very consensus. Every VC thought it was a good company and you might be willing to pay slightly more is how you got into the deal or something, or give slightly better terms. But it didn't seem like people were really going out of a limb, maybe a couple firms as the exceptions, and doing things that were non-consensus. Do you think that changes radically?
The cynical reality of venture capital is that I think in that period you're talking about, it went from being an investing business to an asset management business. And the reason was, is everyone said, if you're a venture capitalist, maybe you run a $100 million fund, we'll use random numbers, you make a little bit of money on the fees, but you really are getting paid for success. You get paid when things work. That's a way less consistent business model. And candidly, as a capitalist, in some ways, a way less good business model than some of the business models that they run out east and buy out way bigger dollars or things like that. And so I think cynically what happened was, a lot of firms that built a brand and had some good names came to the realization that it's better to run lots of dollars than it is necessarily to hit home runs. The fees on it are astronomical and things like that. And so they became with zero interest rate environment where all the public, all the LPs are saying, someone take our money. there became this incentive to run more and more dollars. And the way you do that is actually by having a factory model, a consensus model you can run over and over and over with more scale. Like, you need things to be pretty cookie cutter. That's why factories are good. The second all of a sudden you're in a more bespoke world, which is the way venture capital used to be, and I believe will be again, the markets are less clear. It's harder to run scaled dollars through the system, et cetera. But I will say, as a seed investor by profession these days, it's also a lot more interesting. In our firm, Slow Ventures, when we were doing our post-mortem in the last few years, the good news is we made everyone a lot of money, so people are happy. But it's funny because I'd say we did a bunch of these consensus-y deals where we said, we like the company, we don't love it, but we know how it's going to get a Series A, so we might as well seed it, and then we get the markup and we move on. All of the home runs, though, all the places we've actually made money, Aaron, are the places where we've actually made fundamental bets that other people didn't believe. So it's kind of one of those things where, like, I think of those consensus deals do go away, but I also don't think those are the important companies most of the time.
If you think about, in some ways, the whole model of Tiger as they're investing in this kind of later stage in the VC ecosystem, their whole thing was, okay, we can do these deals much more efficiently. They publicly stated that their IRR hurdle was much lower than a typical VC. They're trying to get, let's say, 12 to 15%. Maybe typical VC is shooting for 20, 25%. Now, of course, the interest rates were much lower back then, so the diff on the interest was still decent. Why do you think that happened, and how do you think that starts to play out in the future?
Well, look, I think why it happened is because the dollars were there. Venture capitalists just respond to incentives. And the reality is, especially in a zero interest world, you had a bunch of big LPs and they said, hey, we need places to put money. You got any places we can put money? And one of the great ideas that came out of that was, oh, well, these companies that otherwise would have gone public, let's just keep them private. You can tell, go to the company and say, hey, don't worry about going public. Don't worry about the public markets, especially good ones. Like, we'll just keep giving you money. We'll make it super easy. We'll make it better terms. We'll make it efficient. You can keep control. So you end up with this weird thing where the private market started competing with what historically was the public market. And then even worse, if we're being talking about this in the deck, what played out is there's this crazy adverse selection problem. If you're a good company and all of a sudden all the private market investors have tons of money, they're like, well, I'll just buy more Stripe. Like, don't go public Stripe. I'll just buy more. The companies that actually went public were like the shittiest companies. And so you ended up with this problem, which is also compounds this whole end of the factory model thing, which is not only that the public market lost its appetite for some of these types of deals that kind of shut down the factory line, but actually the things that did go public through SPACs or all this stuff were like literally the trashiest companies. And so all of a sudden the public market's like, I don't want more of your tech trash. I have my hashtag blame Chamath for this, which is only half joking. But I think what ended up happening, how this all came together really, was like this problem where the Tigers, as an example, but there are many firms that did this, said, look, we can get so big with cheap money that we actually can be an alternative to the public market for companies that otherwise would have been public.
Now in 2021, I think we saw like 70-ish tech companies go public. And I think all of them, except for maybe one, are down from their public mark. Now, that's just because, like, in general, everything is down from the 2021 kind of marks that are out there. Some of these companies are actually still very good companies, but going public kind of sucks. There's this trope in venture capital, oh, go public, it's good for you. But like, being a public company is terrible. Just like, there's probably like a $2 to $3 million a year in costs. It's just like, you go and then you get sued all the time from public shareholders.
That's from Tech 1.0. It's like, thank you, Sarbanes-Oxley.
It's absolutely horrible. I don't know why anyone would want to go public. There's a small number of reasons to go public. I don't see going public earlier happening, like in the future. If you can get access to private money, like, why not wait?
It depends who you ask. Like, Reed Hastings will give you this long speech about how why it's really good to go public early and just rip the Band-Aid off, and how all this stuff about the public market sucking, it's not right because you just need to find the shareholders that are fundamentally aligned with you and the rigor is good. Fine. I think the reality is that post Sarbanes-Oxley and a bunch of the controls, yeah, it's like super expensive to be a public company. Like, you have to be really big to justify it from a cost perspective. The volatility sucks. Like, there's all these problems with it. There's this spectrum of everything from, this is a company I own 100% of, especially in 2023, you can have very large companies that are wholly owned, that grow off cash flow and do great, all the way through to like, I have a bajillion shareholders, to everything in between. And, you know, people will choose different points on that curve. I think it's a tough thing. I mean, there's no question that in general, the public markets do face an adverse selection problem because, to your point, Oren, it's like the high quality companies, there are plenty of very rich funds, LPs, et cetera, that are happy to say, no, we're happy to hold your stock. And even, I mean, there's a whole history. I think I talk about this in the deck, what happened in buyout coming to VC. So if you think about how buyout used to work, it always used to be oriented towards the public market. You bought a company from the public market, you took it private, you did the Blue Horseshoe Loves Anacott Steel thing, stripped it up, fixed it up, whatever you're going to do, and then you put it back public. That was the whole point. That game has completely evolved, and now private equity funds just sell to each other in the same model. That used to be a crazy idea. Like, no one would do that. I suspect that will come to VC as well, right? And we're going to end up with a very heterogeneous capital structure in terms of who owns what assets.
A lot of companies out there that were funded weren't like really tech companies. I mean, you pointed out things like DTC companies, telemedicine, on-demand services. They were kind of like sold as tech, but they weren't really tech. How do you think about like what is tech and what shouldn't be tech?
Tech is a story. In a world where tech is the hot thing people want to buy, everything gets packaged as a tech company. And the reality is in 2023, it's pretty shocking to think of a company that wouldn't use some technology.
Yeah, exactly. Like, who doesn't use most of these tools that are out there? Yeah.
Totally. I think it's just a question of understanding ultimately profitability profiles, what this thing really is, where the leverage is. Is the leverage in tech? Is the leverage in something else? There are things in our portfolio that honestly, if you look at them, we've funded and they don't look at first blush like a tech company. Like, I'll give you an example. One of my favorite companies we've funded is a company called TeamShares. What TeamShares does is it buys tiny, tiny businesses at like a few times cash flow and like does a mini Berkshire Hathaway, or a great company that is kind of an analogy to this. So like, imagine mini Berkshire Hathaway. You're like, that's not a tech company. Yeah, you're right.
Sounds like a private equity firm.
But there's actually a hell of a lot of tech involved because one, they're running screens to figure out which companies they can buy. The ability to manage tons and tons and tons of few million dollar businesses at scale without a huge amount of overhead is very tech enabled. Da, 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 da. Can we argue, is this a tech company? Is it not a tech company? We can argue about it. I'm also sure it doesn't even really matter to some degree.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. If you can make a return, it could be a good investment. Now, there are some of these companies. I mean, we saw some big failures recently, like Convoy, which was an on-demand platform for trucking. To me, these ideas, they're not necessarily terrible. And some of these, you might need a ton of capital. You might need hundreds of millions of dollars at least to get to the network effect. How do you think about these types of businesses that are out there?
I think another good example is places you need tons of capital is obviously like AI, you know, if you're doing base models and things like that. If you need an unbelievable amount of money, venture capitalists don't have it. You got to look at like the top biggest tech companies in the world, which is why, again, I think honestly, the reality is the biggest tech companies in the world, the ones that are going to dominate AI, it's perfect for them. Enormous capital requirements, distribution, data.
In some cases, they may have like $100 billion on the balance sheet that's just like in T-bills.
Right. If you need like an enormous amount of capital, they're going to swamp it. Then there's the, I need $5 million to prove something out, or I like have a good business idea that's going to be super high leverage and da da da, and I'm a great operator. The interesting thing about that is actually, that's great. A lot of people have $5 million. And so the reality is the good news is there's tons of great businesses to build there. Great place to be an operator, right? If you have low capital requirements, figure out. The bad news is that dollars aren't that valuable at that scale because everyone has them. It's just an efficient-ish market, unless you're going to do something weird, which is kind of what I like to do, which is weird stuff, to find things people don't think are good businesses that actually are. Then there's like the medium amount of money, tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. All of a sudden, like you find venture capitalists who say they're in the innovation game, but they're really in the asset management game. I just think a lot of that's going to get washed out because the biggest opportunities that require tons of capital will go to the truly huge platforms. Everyone says, you think about VC as something special. It's not. It's just money. And more people are willing to play in the money game. So I think there's like a whole set of really interesting outcomes from this. But I think per usual in life, I think the really big guys are fine. I think the really small guys are fine, but it'll be competitive. And the middle drops out because the middle always drops out.
Now, you have a great line of report. You said, like, when people ask who will be the Adobe of AI, the answer should be clear and it will be Adobe. Why are you convinced that today's incumbents are going to be able to innovate and capture all the value?
Here's the thing I think people miss is there's this mentality in Silicon Valley that every X years, something happens that's super disruptive and the chessboard gets overturned. There's a whole new game to play. That's like the mentality. So people are like, oh, like the first revolution was a PC, and then it was the internet, and then it was mobile, and then it was crypto, and then it was, you know, AI is the next one. And so people really want that to be true. I mean, if you think about a lot of the VR story, saying that people desperately want disruption that will overturn everything and make all the options available again. I think the reality is a little more nuanced than that in terms of how this stuff works. So if you think about it, the biggest companies in the world are actually the PC era companies that navigated the internet well. The second biggest companies are the internet companies that it turns out that people like mobile was so disruptive. It's like, no, mobile was just more internet. So for the companies that did a good job with more internet, the Metas, the Googles, obviously the Apples and Microsofts, it's great for them. When you think about the transition, what we've seen now, AI is really just more cloud is what it is. You think about who are the customers, what are the APIs you want for them, what are the resources you need. It's not like this is some big disruption to the major platforms. It's like perfect for them. Take Adobe as an example. They have a huge install base in all the creative tools already. Candidly, they've already been working on AI forever. They have access to the hardware. They have access to the huge data sets that you want to like make really interesting uses of creative. It's like they have it all. And so people are like, oh, we have this cool ability to create just from scratch. That is not a product in and of itself. Generative fill, on the other hand, which is like Adobe has 1,000 pieces of tooling and they add one more, is completely obvious. I will be wrong. I want to be clear. There will be exceptions to this framework. Someone's going to come up with something. They always do. As a general rule, every time you get pitched Adobe for AI, you're like, this is perfect for Adobe. They're already cloud native. They're already on a subscription model. They already have the tooling and the distribution. And this is not actually threatening to their model. It just helps them.
To me, the way I think about it when there's this new wave is this in conflict with their current business model? To me, like cloud was clearly in conflict with the old client server business model. And so you saw these cloud companies actually really take massive market share, whether the Workdays of the world or Salesforce or all these different companies that kind of appeared. It was very, very hard for the other companies to make the pivot. Whereas AI seems completely aligned with the current business model. It just makes it better. They're not going to have to like change their pricing dramatically or something.
I have this line, maybe you'll like this. If you're in the management team of a company and a new technology comes out, you see a headline or your engineers show you something new, there's two possible reactions. It's either fuck yeah or oh shit. And AI is like so obviously a fuck yeah for all the big companies. It's not an oh shit. And so it's like clearly who's going to win this.
Yeah, they're embracing it right away. It's not like Blockbuster. They're like, oh, Netflix is going to mess up our whole business model or something. This is like the exact opposite.
I'm not a skeptic on AI having impact in the business ecosystem. I think the biggest companies can get way bigger and like do some cool shit. And I also think it's great if you're small. Just as cloud or like honestly AWS made starting a company way easier, more leverage, you can do more with less. I actually think there's going to be a ton of single digit billionaires made on like niche-y things with like teams of seven people. I think it sucks, though, if you're trying to build a $10 billion company or a platform in the middle. I don't think that's a great place to hunt with AI.
Now, one of the things that you kind of put in your advice there, which I really liked, was every time you raise capital, you should think of it as the last capital you will ever raise. Completely different to the way people have been starting companies, even for the last 30 years, where there's like these stages and we're going to hit these milestones. And once you get the milestone, you prove it out. And if you can't prove it out, your company just goes bust. Why do you think we're going to move into this new world where you have to think of it as you are getting profitable on this money?
You never want to raise money when you need money. And I think what happened in the last decade was people got very comfortable in some ways doing the trapeze without a net because the markets were so well established and the benchmarks were so clear. There was like, I'm just going to hit this benchmark and there's going to be 15 bids and it's fine. But that's not normal. And like, that's not the way the world I think normally works. I also think candidly, unlike the last many years, in many, many business cases, it's extremely reasonable to be unit profitable and profitable on the way. Like people used to say, oh, well, that's just a lifestyle business. You're not going for the goal. But I actually think that's like a very antiquated way to think of it. In fact, it's funny, you know, we just had a conference this morning where I had the CEO, Anthony from Squarespace, and Greg from Muckrack, all these great founders, Wade from Zapier, who have raised nothing, GoodRx, et cetera.
Yeah, these are incredible companies.
These are incredible billion-dollar companies. They didn't raise venture capital. Or if they did, they raised very little amount, and then they just built their businesses. And I think you're going to see more and more and more of that, which is great. I think the reason you don't hear this more, this is not good for the current Silicon Valley business model of venture capital. The Silicon Valley business model of venture capital is a structure which requires lots of capital and lots of rounds so people can buy up continuously, can make marks that make sense, et cetera, and candidly raise more money. I get to kind of play the outsider on this because we run a seed fund. So candidly, I'm happy to go in and when someone says, hey, I need this amount of seed capital and this will get me the $1 million in ARR so I can buy it, start an A, I'm like, please just tell me how much money you need to actually make the business work and let's back into how to finance it from like what you need, which is, again, I'm talking by book. This is good for me.
But if you were even a small seed investor in Zapier, whatever you put in, that could have been 1,000x now, or at least 100x what that is.
Totally. And that's been like my experience too, is like, look, the things that I've backed from zero, where there are literally 1,000x's, are very different patterns to the traditional round-based stuff. And the round-based stuff just kills you. And it's kind of like, if you're killing your seed investors, you're killing your founders as well.
I mean, if you think of like the great companies that we talk about, whether it's Microsoft or Google or Amazon, none of them raise that much money. One of the reasons that the investors in Google made so much money is they just never really got diluted.
It was an option. So again, I'm not saying you should never raise venture capital. I'm just saying there's a massive difference between saying I'm opportunistically open to capital when I know how to use it, when it's going to make the business more valuable, when I have ball control, versus being in a place, which again, I think has been the norm for the last many years, of like this round-based factory model where you kind of are winging it to milestones that don't actually matter anymore. And then just hoping someone catches you, because someone's not going to catch you now.
There's this type of entrepreneur that could really benefit from this new world. And they're kind of like the one who can use hundreds of different vendors and APIs and stitch the thing together. And I often meet these people for whatever reason. They seem like they're often from like Eastern Europe. And it's a very different type of person than like the person who like knows how to recruit and manage people. And how do you think the actual personality type of the entrepreneur might change?
Well, it's funny. You're catching me right after having done this. So we did 6 30-minute talks this morning with a whole bunch of people who have done this. I'll tell you the lessons. One is, I do think it's this interesting thing, which is the founders who seem most successful in this type of world are the people who can actually operate the business themselves end to end. And that doesn't mean they know how to do every single thing, but it does mean that they know how to do a lot and they're really good at figuring out their own answers and figuring it out. So like Scott Marlett, you know, a good friend, one of the founders of GoodRx, talking about how like, look, at one point he was the guy clicking on the Google AdWords stuff. And then when they wanted to run TV ads, he produced it. Of course, he's not the best for you, but it works. I think that skill set of like knowing how to get stuff done and then being smart enough to figure it out, I think is actually critical in the early days. Anthony, again, this morning was talking about how he was incredible. I mean, he did everything. He operated as a Squarespace as a one-person company for years in deep into profitability, but he's terrible at hiring and he has to figure that out. And so I think over time, you need all those skill sets. But I do agree with you, Oren, that like if you think about it, if the factory model encourages CEOs who are good at deploying capital, and that means hiring, allocating resources and things like that, that is a different mentality than the CEO builder who's like able to just do stuff and build profitable things.
I'm a big fan of Saster and the blogs and stuff. It's writing is really about the factory model. It's okay, how do you hire a great VP of sales? And how do you do all these types of things? And in some ways, you're going to have to figure out how to not hire people in some ways. Like that's going to be the way to be success.
Hire a last resort. Like you hire when it breaks to the point that you need someone. And then you hire, if you think about it, one way to think about it is it's raising money. The other way to think about it is just say to yourself, it's selling equity. It's kind of like the second you're hiring people and you're like, this is as an equity holder, the most efficient thing to use money on or to use equity on. That is what it ends up being. And that is a different mentality.
It becomes harder to innovate. When you have lots of people, you just have this coordination problem. You have an N squared coordination. Innovating with 7 people is so much easier than 70. And then, of course, 700, you're just not innovating anymore at that point.
To that point about 700, I mean, this was kind of my commentary. You know, we're now, what, like 10 days after, we're going to date the podcast, since the OpenAI shenanigans. And everyone's like, oh, well, Sam's going to leave with all these people and start a company. There's 18 reasons that's not going to happen, but not the least of which is that you can't run a startup, even one where the people were already working together, with 100 people on day one.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That would just never work.
It would be a recipe for not working.
100%. There's a lot of reasons that the idea of like a spin out of OpenAI wouldn't work. The hardware access, a lot of the things we're talking about. The other one would be like if 100 people or 700 people in their case signed up and said, I'm coming with you. The idea of like showing up at a warehouse on day one with nothing, no domain name, and just being like, hooray, we have 700 employees is hilarious.
One of the things that you and I are both passionate about are income share agreements. Do you think there's a world where like ISAs become more mainstream?
The thing for me, when I think about kind of the future of, again, this is in the DAC and like kind of related, is like I'm very bullish on small businesses. We've been investing in a lot of small business platforms, et cetera. I think one huge categories of that are creator-driven businesses.
Businesses of one or few people helping them.
Or businesses where like you have the guy or the girl who's built a really deep community and niche around something and they know it well and they're trusted well. It's funny because as a firm, we've started doing these deals where we'll buy 5 or 10% of a creator's lifetime earnings, which means we get 5% of all the thing they make as a creator. But then if they build companies, we get 5% of the company.
How do you structure that? Like, how does that work?
You basically can just put together a holdco. And then basically you have like an assignment agreement between the person and the holdco about what goes into the holdco.
And you say the Sam Lesson brand is now part of this holdco, essentially?
Basically. Anything that Sam Lesson, the individual, does over the next 30 years goes into the topco. And you own 95% of it and I own 5% of it. I mean, that's a shorthand of how it works.
There might even be some nice tax things that could be good for the individual, just the fact that they have this holdco. So maybe giving you that 5 or 10% is free with some of the structures they could do or something.
We're happy to do the, like, you know, we'll put a few million dollars into the holdco in the right vertical, which makes sense. So I do think, we think about income share agreements, I am very anti-debt. I think it's an antiquated model of financing people because it makes no sense. It's like designed for people with very predictable earnings. That's incredibly cheap and good if you know what you're going to make. It's a terrible product in a world of discontinuity. We live in a world of discontinuity. And so the idea that you can invest in people and say, hey, if you make a ton of money, I'm right there with you. I helped finance you getting there. If you make nothing, you owe me nothing. Directionally, I agree with. And then specifically, we're absolutely doing this specifically for content creators and communities where we see opportunities for them to like generate short-term revenue from their community itself, but then build really interesting products. Like, I don't want to invest in Mr. Beast's Burgers. That was like clearly a terrible investment, even though people were excited about it for a second. But I'm happy to invest in Mr. Beast. I'm not sure at the valuations I've heard being tossed around, but that is the right mentality.
If you're going to invest in like people and you're really trying to get an upside, you really want to make sure that you're investing in people that are quite ambitious. And I think that is a very hard thing to do. One thing for a company with people, sometimes they reach a level of comfort where they're doing quite well. And now they have all this access to things and now they have a family. And then for a lot of people, which is great for them, now they have a great lifestyle, like they don't need anymore and they're not necessarily ambitious. How do you interview for ambition?
I mean, I've had this thesis about investing in people, I think, as of you, for ages. You know, I bought the domain lifecapital.com in 1999 and tried to start this company. This is a long burn thing for me. I 100% believe that long-term equity-style financing people is the right way to go. I can't answer that question entirely. I can answer for creators. For creators, the nice part about them is they are people, but they're also like very clearly entrepreneurs that have embedded metrics. How many will follow them? What does engagement look like? How much money are they already making? Now, will some of them reach some level of success and tap out? Of course. When it comes down to like who are good bets and like what are you betting on, the reason we invest in them as the piece of the ISA-ish thing we do, they're the easiest to measure and understand, I would argue, from zero in a way that the average person is much harder so far.
And you could also make an argument, maybe you can make the opposite argument, which I'd be interested in what you said, that because creators, it's a little bit harder to like predict. It's not like someone who can like shoot a basketball. It's like a little bit harder to predict who's going to end up being like super good later on, that having that startup capital actually might give you an edge to get there.
We don't want to do the entertainment vertical in creators. Like, I'm actually not that into entertainers versus people who are like, I'm the god of lawn care. I'm the god of outdoor barbecue. I'm like really into like these esoteric, but actually shockingly large niches where you understand what community is. That said, probably the biggest creator in the world that everyone knows, Jimmy, Mr. Beast, you can kind of study a little bit what worked and what didn't. One of the things he did is it turns out that like effectively giving away money or lighting money on fire is an incredibly cost-efficient way to grow. Why? Well, it's because no one else was doing it. A lot of his early videos he grew on is like, I'll give you $10,000 to do something completely random. People love that shit. I've always joked the best marketing for a venture firm would be to go to the middle of Market Seat and just light $100,000 on fire. Way better use per impression of any marketing dollar you're going to get anywhere else. I do think that especially now when capital is constrained for creators, the money gun can be valuable. And that goes back to this whole point about if you're going to raise so you never need to again. I think putting a creator and putting them on some sort of money losing trajectory where they have to raise more and more money doesn't make a lot of sense. But you could take a creator who's doing fine and say, hey, would $3 million make you grow twice as fast this year? And then the compounding on that is just astronomically better.
That's a question I really don't understand is, what could the money do? Why does it make it better for the creator? Why will they grow? There's this one point where they de-risk it, but I don't think that's interesting. I think really what you want them to do is take that money and invest it. And with an athlete, I don't know, maybe they can get a better diet or hire a better trainer or something. What does it do for the creator?
Yeah, I'll give you a few examples of how this comes up. So one thing is you just buy distribution, and that I think is a legitimate use in some cases. I think the second thing that can come up a lot is it turns out that there's a lot of places where as a creator, if you have money to invest, you can do way better deals. A lot of creators are price takers. People come to them and they're like, okay, I want to advertise on your channel or something. They're like, great. But the second you're like, can I co-brand this with you? Can I invent the product? Can I make my version of the product? Like the margin profile changes dramatically in terms of what you can and can't do.
Got it. So you're taking some risk essentially because you don't need to pay bills. You don't need to go pay rent. So you're taking a little risk to do that.
Well, you're just like, look, I could go sell your barbecue brush or I could just make my own barbecue brush. And then I think the most extreme version is like, again, start businesses. The cool part about being a creator in this world, and I think, is you basically have free distribution in the niche you have. And that's awesome. That basically is a business model innovation if your CAC is zero. And so if you are entrepreneurial, most aren't, but some are, and you're like, there's a company to start or several companies, a service company or a product I want to build or whatever. The fact that your CAC can be zero because you own the distribution is so valuable in terms of like building interesting stuff.
Do you know Thomas Frank at all?
I'm not sure I know Thomas Frank.
He's got this super niche thing where all he talks about is like Notion. He loves Notion, the company Notion. And he's like super into it. He's got gazillion views on YouTube. He makes most of his money selling Notion templates. He makes money doing advertising. That's great. But like his core driver, my guess is he makes probably 60-70% of his revenue from selling Notion templates.
The question for someone like that is, I mean, again, I have no idea how that business obviously works for him. Could he make more if he had an investment or better? Is there some other software thing that he knows about or some Notion attachment that would do really well? I don't know. There could be really interesting stuff.
Absolutely. Now, what do you think about these venture studios, these incubators? How do you think they're going to fare?
My cynical take is this, which is every smart product person leaves whatever successful company they're at. And they say, you know, it'd be really great. I have lots of ideas. I'm going to come up with the ideas and then I'm going to find people to do the work.
Someone else is going to do all the hard work.
And like, that would be awesome because I have just the greatest ideas. The history of these things are they never fucking work. The only exceptions are people, and this has been done. Max Levchin did this. He said, look, I'm not really doing a studio, but I will start a few things and see what works and then shut everything else down and double, triple down on. So it could be like a product exploration thing. If you're going to stamp out a very self-similar type of business, like you're in the DTC world and you're going to do 87 versions of blank and you're going to build a competency on a very specific go-to-market and whatever else, it can work to a point. In general, the studio thing is the classic hallmark of, I totally understand why people want it because it's really fun. I love the vision. The problem is that any good entrepreneur, if they're like, hey, would you rather have 100% of something or start it? Or like, you be the operator and do all the hard work, but I'm the idea guy and I want 60% of the cap table. You get the bad people. It doesn't work.
If you think of when Google changed its name to Alphabet, essentially they're like, we're going to become a startup studio because that's more fun.
I think it's partially because it's more fun. And then I think this concern is slightly different. It's really hard to spend that level of capital. You have to imagine at some point Google had a decision, which was, we make so much money that we can try to return it as a dividend. But if we're too profitable, like the world is going to hate us so much, we're going to get ripped apart.
The government would just shut them down. They need less profitable things to spend it on.
Or our advantage all of a sudden is that we have so much money, we have to find weird opportunities that can even take that amount of money. And it turns out there just aren't that many things you can spend that much money on. If anything, so much of the problem we see in the startup world is the startup world ended up with way too much money and they didn't know where to put it. Think about that on steroids was the Google problem.
Now, a couple of personal questions. You have a very popular tweet on your dislike of Calendly. Why is that such a bad thing?
Oren, I have a special announcement for your community, which is not only do I have that, but I actually have built my first product in a while, which is anti-Calendly. I would love to show it to you and show it to your members soon. But coming soon, well, not only do I double down on my tweet of I hate Calendly, but I hate it so much that I built anti-Calendly as a product.
And what does it do? Like scrapes your email?
Well, we'll save the reveal for soon, but let's just say like, yes. And like, here's the upshot. My tagline is don't live your life FIFO, first in, first out. Like that's a terrible way to schedule. Like the idea that if you have a meeting coming up, the way you fill your life of meetings is whoever happens to email you gets the availabilities and then you wake up and execute the calendar as laid out for you every day. Look, there are places it makes sense. If you're doing lead gen.
Inside salesperson.
If you're a salesperson and you're just filling like slots, you're not sure, fine. There are places for it. But I actually think we've all become slaves to calendars because of things like Calendly. We don't wake up and say, what should I do right now? What is the most important thing to execute? Who do I need to talk to? Instead, we say, I'm going to follow the script of whoever happened to fill these holes last week. It's not optimal. There's so many things that should be a phone call that end up being a 30-minute meeting all because of Calendly. So I don't know. We can get into it, but I like Topher. He's a good guy. I think it's a clever product. They've clearly crushed it. Congrats on the business. I hate the product experience.
Okay, got it. Two of my favorite questions. One is, what is a conspiracy theory that you believe?
That's a great question, Oren. I don't believe a lot of conspiracy theories.
I think you do, actually. I mean, we've hung out a lot. I think I've probably heard at least a dozen out of your mouth over the years that are really good.
Conspiracy theories, I believe? Oh, like, give me one, then. Help jog my memory here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know which ones are safe for this podcast. I think you have quite a few pretty controversial takes about these things are going on because of these forces or something.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll give you one that's top of mind for me. That is, I don't think it's a conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory implies it's like not true. I guess that's the problem.
No, it doesn't.
All right. So I absolutely believe that TikTok is a tool of the Chinese government. And not intentionally. I think TikTok's a cool product, whatever. But I absolutely believe that just like OpenAI has this governance problem where like there's something above it that controls the for-profit company and can do weird things that make it hard to trust. The second that the Chinese want to invade Taiwan, you better believe that TikTok will have been softening the beaches by infiltrating American youth and convincing them that China should do that. And then there will be a real shit show.
Do you think TikTok is any different than any other Chinese-owned company, whether it's Huawei or a drone company or some of these other things?
Well, I think the difference is that no other Chinese company has direct reach into hundreds of millions of Americans every day as the increasing source of news for it. I think it's literally insane from a national security perspective that we allow a foreign competitor that like is threatening allies of ours to like control the news feed of like hundreds of millions of Americans every day. It's such an incredible breach from a national security perspective.
If you were U.S. dictator for the day, what would you do differently?
You just ban it.
So you think we should go as crew? Because obviously there's a lot of implications of banning whatever. It's like, what are you banning? And who makes the decision? How does it work? Can you just ban anything? Like, it's like, oh, we're banning Spotify or something.
I don't ban Spotify. I like Spotify. I think there's the why hasn't this already happened, which is really interesting. Who could stop it? Well, Apple could, but they're the most beholden company ever to China. The people aren't going to do it. If anything, the reality is, especially on the left, the kids love TikTok. And so the Democrats won't do it because they're worried about losing the extreme left of voters. So there's all these interesting dynamics. So there's a question of like, why no one will move on this. And then there's the question of like, practically, how would you do it? Under what regime? And like, there's this stuff we ban ZTE under certain premises of enemy companies and things like that. There's also like this whole idea of foreign media ownership. We have, for obvious reasons, rules against foreign broadcast ownership and like how far that extends. Does the internet fit under that? When Rupert wants to buy more media properties, it gets questioned. Why isn't this? The actual like mechanism you use, I think, is hard. But the basic idea being like, it is literally insane, if you want to talk about conspiracy theories, that we allow a country to like have access to, believe it or not, it's even better than like a social network, because since it's just whatever they think the best video to show you is, it's even easier for them to just like change subtly what gets shown to whom in a way that kind of has massive implications for what people believe.
Just to push a little bit, Spotify is not an American-owned company. It has a massive amount of market share. You and I probably spend way more time on Spotify than we do on TikTok. We have our playlist, but they also recommend lots of songs and lots of different things. They could definitely subtly recommend many things to change our mind about stuff, things with certain lyrics. Why are we not worried about, you could see it's something where we sort of worry about everything.
There's the obvious reason, which is China has a pretty strong history of deciding to muck with what companies do and don't do when they feel like it. There's a way less separation between the state and their for-profit companies than I think in other regimes.
In Sweden or something.
If you ended up with a rule that was large-scale foreign media ownership, and as part of that, Spotify needed to get a waiver, fine. Like, if that's really the ultimate solution, fine. I don't think it'd be very hard for them to.
Now, if we start moving the other way, does that mean Facebook's going to have trouble operating in Italy now? And
yes. And by the way, that's part of the reason why this hasn't been a big deal historically, is the reality is, are we net winners or net losers on something like this? Like, the net loser case is, well, we export a hell of a lot of American culture around the globe with American internet products. We've done fabulously well.
And movies, and a lot of countries like France had to implement quotas for movies because they were worried the French movies would be taken over.
So I think you're 100% right. In the Pax Americana of the last several decades, this globalized view of the world said, we'll accept a little interference in our space because we're such huge net exporters and such value to that. It's fine. I just think the stakes are dramatically higher than they used to be. And the reality is, we're in a protectionist period. We're in a period where borders are being shut down in a lot of different places, and there's a lot more competition. It's no longer Pax Americana. And I think that the reality is, if the collateral damage ends up being like more limitations on our media properties abroad, but we're able to protect the speech space internally of our country from like direct foreign national interference, that seems like a trade we have to make, even if it's not a great one. We already are living in that world. Like, the European internet and the American internet are diverging. What Europe asks companies to do to comply versus the US is different. I mean, heck, California has a different regime. So I think the reality is, people like of our generation, Oren, we grew up with this idealized, globalized version of the internet, which was awesome. I really believe and believed at the time. But I think you have to come to terms with the fact that with the level of gatekeepers, different regulatory regimes, and also like the raw power implications of some of these things, just as we're seeing borders go up in a lot of places, the idea that some borders come up around keeping our information space, our civil society and free speech safe is like kind of important.
Now, the last question we ask all of our guests, what conventional wisdom or advice do you think is generally bad advice?
Most advice is bad advice. So much. My biggest takeaway, again, it's very top of mind. We just had this little mini conference, is just, people have a very contentious time with this like follow your passion thing. The kind of general knock on it is, everyone says, yeah, that's what really successful people say after they've been successful, is, oh, just follow your passion. But here's the thing, having just spoken to a bunch of entrepreneurs who built incredibly successful companies that they own their way on their terms, they didn't get caught in the factory system. I really think you should start from that, which is, startups and companies are super hard. You know, you got to figure out how you're going to get out of bed every day and do what you're doing. And there's no way you're going to do it unless you absolutely love it and believe in the model you're running. And so I really just believe that you really need to live for yourself and work for yourself for your own goals. And you're going to be unhappy and unsuccessful trying to fit other people's molds. That goes for capital raising too. Don't sit there and manufacture plans to get your Series A. Figure out what a good business is and build it.
I actually have one more question for you. More of a personal question. So I met you originally way, 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 way back when through your now wife, Jessica, but you guys were like college sweethearts. Then you guys get married. That's not typical today. If you're giving like love advice to somebody, what type of advice would you give to them?
What's funny is it's not typical, but I actually look around my friend group and so many of us started dating in college or right after it.
And it's so awesome when it works. You guys are an incredible couple. It's so awesome when it works out. Well, it does seem so rare though.
I think there's like a few models of successful relationships. And one of them is, you just kind of grow up together. I actually find it's funny. I have a small number of friends who are now, I'm 40, and they're kind of around my age, and they haven't been married. A lot of them are super successful, great people, and they have a really hard time finding someone. I think part of the reason is at a certain point, you know who you are, and you also like know what you like and don't like. And so the target area of what you're looking for becomes incredibly small. Whereas the other model, which I think candidly Jess and I fell into, is I think we kind of shaped each other growing up. We kind of were like, this person's awesome. I love them. They're great. So it's interesting.
You've now been together for like half your life.
Almost exactly. I do think that's a different model, which is to kind of find a person or a thing, you know, and you just like deeply are committed and they're awesome and you kind of grow with them. And then like you end up, it kind of figures out. Now, there's plenty of stuff that we disagree on or that are challenges, but like I think overall, I don't think I have love advice as much as that kind of model of, I do think there's different ways to think about partnership. And there's no question. It's funny you say that it doesn't happen so often. In our friend group, like a ton of people fit that pattern. I think it's all people who kind of just grew up together.
All right, that's great. Thank you, Sam Lessin, for joining us on World Desk. I follow you at Lessin on Twitter, X, or whatever it's called. I definitely encourage our listeners to engage with you there. This has been a ton of fun.
It's always fun, man. Good to see you, Aaron.
Great to see you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating this podcast and leaving a review. For more World of DAS, and DAS is DAAS, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also check out YouTube for videos. You can find me at Twitter at Auren, that's A-U-R-E-N, Auren, and we'd love to hear from you. World of DAS is brought to you by Safegraph. Safegraph is geospatial data for physical places. Check it out at safegraph.com. And by Flex Capital. Flex Capital invests in data companies like those we talk about at World of DAS. Check it out at flexcapital.com.